They've all been very, very favorable. The reaction has been absolutely first class. The reaction has been similar to the reaction we had to the 83 Thunderbird, but even, I think, much more positive, because these cars are what we call clean piece of paper cars. I mean, there are, you know, there's hardly a carryover nut or bolt on these cars. Every component is new. Everything is well done. I mean, it's a no-excuse car. If we don't get these cars, a Taurus and Sable, right, we just have to point the fingers at ourselves. We can't blame anyone else. I mean, there are cars, and I think everyone involved in the program has stood behind the cars. And probably one of the most encouraging aspects of it is, I think, everyone that's been on the program and others throughout the corporation that have seen the cars all want to buy these cars. That's all there is to it. I mean, you can't get a better vote of confidence than that. People just plain want them. But on just design specifically, now, again, we wanted best-in-class aerodynamics, so that really had a very strong influence on the overall shape and form of the car, and that's why you'll notice that we're continuing on with this aero look that we really initiated on the 83 Thunderbird, but in a much more refined way, but it's very definitely an evolutionary design theme that we're developing in the Ford Motor Company. It's our look, and frankly, I think if we didn't develop these kinds of cars and this kind of a look, I think the motoring public would be disappointed. They expect it from us now. Mm-hmm. I think aerodynamics are the price of admission. We established aerodynamics in the automobile industry. We were criticized for aerodynamics by our competitors, I think for one very simple reason, and that is they simply didn't have aero, so they had to say, you know, we didn't know what we were doing. Now they're all trending that way, which we predicted, by the way. Mm-hmm. We knew our competition would have a choice, that they would have to follow aerodynamics. They could not continue to build boxes. Mm-hmm. However, we will not be beating the drums about aero as much as we have in the past. I think it's just, as I said, the price of admission. People do expect aero. We will have best-in-class aero, and I don't think we have to talk about it as much. The car makes an aero statement, and it's, and people accept it now. And people don't accept it. I think the most pleasing part about it is people aren't accepting the design because it is aero. If we brought this car out 5 years ago, people would probably ask, why did you do this car? Why does it look this way? And then we'd have to tell them aero. Mm-hmm. Now they look at it and they say, I like it. And, oh, by the way, it is very aerodynamic, isn't it? And that's the approach that we like, and we think we've established that look. And it's our look, it's our Ford look, and we're getting a lot of credit for it. And it's a new look, and that's important. We want to be new, we want to be different, but it has to be new and different and good. And we think that we're on very solid ground with this design premise that we're using on these cars. So the cars have a lot of new features with their new flush aero headlamps with polycarbonate lenses. The lenses of the headlamps are 10 times stronger than the seal beam headlamps that we use on cars today. We have polycarbonate bumpers, which are extremely strong.
It's
a new plastic. Polycarbonate is a plastic that we're using in these bumpers. And the bumpers and headlamp lenses are made of the same material, just that the headlamps are a clear version of it. The headlamp material is stronger than sheet metal. You know, it will be more resistant to dents and breakage than sheet metal, which is great. And then because most headlamp breakage occurs from stone impact, well, these will be very resistant to that sort of thing. And if a lens does crack, it may crack, but the light will still function. And if a bulb ever burns out, you just simply change the small bulb in the back of the lens, so in the back can. So it's a very simple operation. You can carry spare bulbs with you in your car. It's not a problem. So a lot of features. These are customer pluses. And we're coming up with other new features on the cars also. We have the InstaClear windshield. It'll be an industry first. We'll have the first windshield on the car that will melt a quarter of an inch of ice within in less than 2 minutes, I think about a minute and a half, your windshield will be completely melted, which is really great, and especially in the climate we live in, and all the northern parts of the country. It's a totally new technique, and this windshield was developed by our Ford Glass division, so it's an in-house development, and that's really nice, and I think you'll see that as a very big plus feature on these cars. I hope we tell people about it, because I find it, we had this some time ago on a Mark, but it was a totally different concept. But we did have a heated windshield on the Mark.
How does this one look?
Well, this has it's a different laminate that they're using, a new type of laminate that they're using between the laminated glass, a film. It's zinc, I think it's zinc, it's some kind of a zinc aluminum combination. I can't give you the technical details on it, but anyway, it is impressive. As opposed to this gold film that we used on the Mark several years ago, which is an extremely extremely expensive process. You know, it was about $1,000 to replace the windshield on a Mark if you broke one. Where we think this will be about a $200, $250 type option or something like this. So they really got the cost out of it, and it's much more effective, a much faster meltdown.
What do you have for what's the melting agent? Is it a sophisticated wiring system? Or?
Yeah, no, it's not. It's just this film, this metal film that's built into the laminate, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Which is transparent, it's clear.
How does it melt the ice?
Well, it's heated.
It is heated.
It's electrically heated, yeah. But it's a film, so you don't see any lines or grid or anything like that. It's just clear. It has a slight bronze color to it, you'll notice from the exterior of the car, but it's hardly perceptible. But the interior of the car, the instrument panels, are all ergonomically laid out, planned, and designed. And we have, by the way, more differential between the Taurus and the Sable, or the Ford and the Mercury, than we've had on cars in this, or ever had on cars in this range. And that was, again, one of our design objectives. The sheet metal is totally unique between the two cars. Now, there's very definitely a very strong family resemblance between these cars, which was planned. There's a common thread working through these cars between the Ford and the Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
But, so you know they're out of the same stable, but yet they're very unique cars in their own ways. And where the Mercury moves up range, and it's detailing, very, very little bright detailing on the Mercury. We've achieved bright value without the use of chrome. For example, the Mercury has a full width light bar grille, which is done in polycarb. And so we get this bright effect without adding chrome to the car. There's no chrome in the bumpers, no chrome in the side moldings, in the protection moldings. There's just bright detailing around the window glass, which, by the way, is flush. We have flush glass, 360-degree flush windshield, flush side glass, and flush backlights.
First time.
So we will be the first American manufacturer to have flush glass, 360-degree flush glass in these cars. So the cars have a lot of newness, and interior and exterior-wise, you will notice these cars on the road very definitely. I mean, I followed one over here on Allen Road just the other day, and you can't help but notice these cars on the road. I think that's good news. I mean, you can notice things that are bad also, but you will notice these, and hopefully people will like them. Not just they'll notice the stance of these cars. We really had a very concerted effort here to get better tread on these cars. We have a better tire to sheet metal relationship on these cars, mm-hmm. than we've had on any other car. European cars are known for a good stance and a good tready look. I think the Audi 5000 is a good example of that. And yet, when you put an Audi 5000 next to either of these cars, the wheels on the Audi look as if they're tucked under the car, which was the syndrome that we were caught up in with in Detroit for years.
Mm-hmm.
So these cars are the best in the industry for this look. We want to be best in class in aesthetics also on these cars, and I think we've achieved a lot of that. But stance is really key. If you get the right tread to sheet metal relationship on a car, you're off to a pretty good start. Get the right glass planes in, you're off to a good start. And we got those basic building blocks, those basic ingredients that we put in place. And the people here in the design center put a lot of that in place. And our package people especially, and we work with our engineers. And our engineers supported us. And I think a lot of it had to do with Lou Veraldi and Lou Veraldi's European experience.
Mm-hmm.
Lou and I, by the way, worked on the Fiesta program in Europe. And that was another, in my opinion, best-in-class car, one of the hottest cars we'd ever done. The smallest car we'd ever done, but probably the best quality car we've ever built in the country. And Lou applied the same engineering philosophy to the Taurus and Sable that he applied to that car. And every last detail has been scrutinized and gone through and blessed by Lou, and we consensed on it with this, groups that we were working with throughout the corporation. And just made sure that every detail was the best on these cars, and I think the cars really show that now. It's going to pay off. But I think the cars are exciting. They're a new shape. They're aero. They make a strong statement on the road. They will look like nothing else in their class. We've had a number of competitive makes in for comparison. We've had them on test trips, and at this point, I'm just talking about the design of the car. And when you get into the dynamics of the car, the performance and handling, I think you'll find that they are just superb automobiles. We really deliver on the promise suggested by the design of these cars. I mean, we our objective was to design a car that did suggest the dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've done our job, and our engineering community has gone beyond what I ever expected we would develop in this corporation for handling and ride characteristics, and just the total vehicle that we wound up with is I think just a result of a great effort on the part of everybody in the company. And it was a real team process that we used. Everybody felt part of the team that worked on the project, from the designers here, through engineering, through manufacturing, through our suppliers. Everyone felt totally involved in these cars. I've never seen anything like this on a project in the company. This has to be the best project I've ever been involved in yet in my time with the company. And because it was such a unified effort, people were listened to, people contributed to this program, people have part of themselves in these cars. They really do. I've just never seen a project like this, and I think it shows, it will show in the final production vehicles.
Can you go back a bit and detail some of the discussions with the product planners, with the engineers and designers, and perhaps where the first impetus came for this type of a car? I believe you were, the thought would be you would replace a fairly conventional older set of cars that were still selling, but you felt that were rapidly becoming an anachronism. At least back in the early 80s.
Well, the cars that we're replacing are the today's LTD and Marquis. Now, these are not the full-size LTD Crown Victoria, it's the LTD Marquis.
Right.
And which are very conventional, very traditional cars, selling very well. They're rear-wheel drive. I think the cars are nicely proportioned. Well, we must be doing something right with these cars, because, as I said, they are selling extremely well right now. And naturally, when you try to replace something like that, what we consider a winner, you have to use a little bit of caution, because we've really, I think, moved 180 degrees from those cars. And I think a lot of people thought, well, there's a lot of risk. Why really? Well, but I think when we set out the initial objectives, we knew that we were going for a different type of automobile, yet we were going for the same market segment. And the big question, the underlying question in all our discussions was, how much will the customer really reach? How much can we really pull away from LTD and Marquis? Well, I think we crossed that bridge when we made the decision to go to front-wheel drive. I mean, here's, you know, all of a sudden we're talking about totally different vehicle dynamics. And by the way, Lou Veraldi's direction and objective on front-wheel drive was, and you won't believe this, make those front-wheel drive cars handle like rear-wheel drive cars. And at that point, you have to ask yourself, well, why do a front-wheel drive car? Well, it's because competition was going that way, and, you know, we've had...
Way to the future.
Well, you know, I'm not so sure about that, Dave, because you'll hear a lot of pro and con. Now, all the buff people prefer rear-wheel drive, and people that drive in the snow, a lot of people that drive in the snow like front-wheel drive, but the real car handling types don't care. They can still drive rear-wheel drive in the snow. I've been doing it all my life, so... It doesn't matter. They're, you know, we can satisfy both needs. We really can. And I think we could all have a discussion on front versus rear-wheel drive cars until hell freezes over, and it really doesn't make any difference. You can do good cars both ways, and there are advantages to both. And we can offer both, and we will offer both. We'll continue on both. We're not putting all our eggs in one basket and going one way or the other. And I don't believe one will take over the other. I'll just say one more thing about front versus rear-wheel drive. Look at some of our competition. Say the big boys, people that automobile manufacturers that are really respected, like Mercedes. I think we're on safe grounds when we talk about Mercedes. They've got all the research and development money that any automobile manufacturer would ever want. At least that's the way it looks to me. And they recently have brought out two new models. Well, they brought out the 190 Mercedes, which is a small car, it's about the size of our Tempo Topaz. Our Tempo Topaz, of course, are front-wheel drive, and most cars in the U.S. in that segment are front-wheel drive. Well, here's Mercedes walking in the door with all the R&D money in the world, and what do? Developed a whole new car, clean piece of paper car. Guess what? Rear-wheel drive. Well, so much for front-wheel, but so damn good. Why isn't Mercedes doing it, you know? Why isn't BMW doing it if it is really so good? Why don't the big boys do it? Now Mercedes just brought out that new mid-series. I believe they call it the 300 in Europe. I'm not sure what they'll call it in this country. It hasn't arrived here yet. By the way, I think a great-looking car, the best-looking Mercedes they've ever done aesthetically, mm-hmm. really. I don't think the 190 is a good-looking car. Well-built, obviously, well-engineered. Design-wise, it's kind of a zero car. But the new 300 series Mercedes, I think, is very well done. Again, what did they do? Rear-wheel drive. Now, they didn't have to. Nobody put a gun to their head and said, have they? I think they made a very logical decision and went through a logical, I'm assuming it's a logical process to arrive at that conclusion, and they decided rear. So that's why I'm saying front-wheel drive isn't the be-all to end-all. But we are doing it. It's more a marketing need, not, I don't think it's, I don't believe it's a marketing necessity, but in this environment, we have to, I think, take these issues into consideration, and if that's the way it's trending in the U.S., why not be there? Now, there are some interior advantages to going front-wheel drive. Obviously, you get a lower front compartment floor, which allows us to have six-passenger seating in a car this size, which is really, you know, really great. So, I mean, there are a lot of really good advantages to it, and we are taking advantage. But I just thought it was interesting to note that Lou Veraldi's direction was, and he signed up to this, give me a front-wheel drive car that handles like a rear-wheel drive car. And I got to tell you, it does. And
it does? Yeah.
And I got to tell you this, it'll be the best-handling front-wheel drive sedan in its class. There's no question about that, Dave. And they had opportunities in engineering because this was the first car that we actually did driving market research on. We had dynamic market research on these cars down in Florida. I think it was right around Christmas time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we had both the Taurus and the Sable down there, sedans and wagons, and have people drive them. And the only issue that people were concerned about on driving and performance on handling the cars was steering for parking. Some people thought that the power steering on it was just a little taut. They would have gone for a little less effort. And I was really proud of the Ford Motor Company and our engineering group that decided, because if we do that, we'll lose some of the linear effect that we have on down the road steering, say at 50 miles an hour, and they wouldn't sacrifice that just for a little more, for a little less parking effort. Now the parking effort is absolutely minuscule. I mean, it doesn't even faze me. I don't even notice it. It doesn't matter. But I'm talking about a very typical average American driver who would possibly notice something like that. But I will guarantee you, get used to that the first time they drove the car around the block and parked it a few times. I mean, they just wouldn't even, it's absolutely no problem at all. But anyway, we would have backed down and I said, oh, we must have a soft, cushiony ride and one of these super easy power steering, effortless power steering units in here that where you lose all feel of the car and all down the road feel. And we didn't do that. Our engineers maintained the steering integrity on this car, and I'm just super proud of them for sticking to it and believing in what they're doing and going for it, because it will pay off. I mean, I'll tell you, once people get in these cars and drive these cars, they'll never go back to the old traditional type of ride and handling that we've had in typical American cars. These are superb automobiles. Now, I'm kind of talking out of school because I have nothing to do with the steering and handling and performance of these cars. I mean, I affect handling and performance somewhat with aerodynamics of the vehicle and with lift characteristics aerodynamically, but not with any of the mechanicals. But because of the concerted effort that we had on the development of these cars, I think we wound up with a couple of superb automobiles that we really have. But the proof is in the pudding, and I tell people, you know, that have seen these cars that seem to be very enthusiastic about it, that's only half the story. You know, it's one thing to fall in love with a car, to look at it, and that's important because you have to get people in the showrooms to buy them.
Right.
And so I think we've done our part in design. We'll get people in the cars. We'll get them in the showrooms. Hopefully they'll open the doors, get in, sit down in the cars. But when they turn that key and drive them out of the showroom, they'll really have the surprise of their lives and find out that these are absolutely first-class or best-in-class automobiles. And I think we've completed the circle on those cars. And
take you back to the early discussions. How early do you remember that you began talking seriously about a new generation of Fords?
Well, I'm kind of lousy on dates as to when we actually started the program, Dave.
Less the dates than more the discussions that ensued, the early exploratory discussions, the next stage decisions, and what kind of give and take you had between the various units of the team, how senior management viewed it.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we established at the outset of the program, that we wanted a best-in-class automobile. We all subscribed to that, put that stake in the ground. And then when we came back into design, we explored a number of design themes, with aerodynamics being the driving force behind the design, which when we consensed on that, we knew what our aero objectives would be on the cars. And we also set out, in design, just in-house now, yeah, aesthetically, right, set down a few rules, ground rules. And one that was a real driver, and we set it in as a discipline, was we wanted this car to look like no other car on the road, right down to all the detailing of the car. We didn't want people to even look at or try to function a door handle and feel that they had seen this door handle before. Even the door handles are unique, different. Mm-hmm. I think every piece of detailing on this car is unique. People have never seen it before. And however, you say, well, how far can you go with that? You know, you still want them to recognize this as an automobile and not some strange piece of architecture out there. But we felt that if we really held to our functional design theories, that it could be different and still be good and well done, well executed. And this was key to it. And everybody subscribed to that. Now we, you know, explored a number of early design themes and went in a number of different directions and with our basic proportions, at some points I think we got very, very soft and very, I don't want to say too aerodynamic. There's no such thing as being too aerodynamic, but some of them got a little, you'd never seen these shapes before, but they were just plain unusual and not comfortable. And it's hard to describe and hard to understand why a design is good. When do you know you've arrived at the right design? When is the overall proportion really correct? Aesthetically correct. When is it good? How, if you've never seen it before, how do you know it's correct? You know, this is the crystal ball area that we're working in all the time. But we went through that. I set in some disciplines here in the design center with teams. I set up tourist teams. This is the first time we'd ever done this. And I set this team up so that the designers and engineers and modelers on the program would handle the project. We used to say from cradle to grave. I thought that was kind of a bleak outlook on the cars. I now say from conception to birth.
Much better.
And the same team has been following the car all the way through. And we eliminated our feasibility studio at the time we were working on this project. So that all feasibility for this car was handled by this one design team. They did not hand over in the past, you know, for years in this building, the production studio would develop the car, design the car, and then hand it over to the feasibility studio for final feasibility. And every time the car would be handed over to them, they would feel obligated to change it. I mean, it's just human nature. That's all there is to it. Whether it needed it or not, they change it.
Raise on debt.
Right, right. Well, in this case, I believe that if one team handles it, we'll save a lot of time if we don't change it, step one. And number two, I think by maintaining the same team with their enthusiasm and interest and responsibility for the car, they will maintain the original design intent because it's theirs. They believe in it. They understand why they did it. And we would have more design continuity throughout the program if we could do that. And we did this. And this was the first car line we did that on. Now we're continuing to operate that way in all of our studio. And our feasibility studio is gone forever. There is no separate feasibility studio. The fees is handled right in the production studio with the people that develop the car. They are responsible for it. And I think the designers and engineers and modelers on the program really appreciated that much more. They became much more of a team. We also did one other thing. For about the first year of the program, we had the interior and exterior of this car handled under one director, and it was Bob Zokas on that. And that was really, I think, it worked out very well. Then when interiors finally got to the approval stage, we kept the same design group on it, but they came under Trevor Creed in the interior studio because they had all the wherewithal and all the facilities to really carry on the project from there. But it was the same initial design team, however, that still maintained the program all the way through. And I think that paid off. And I tried a couple of other things on this car. I had a real effort going on here to get best-in-class detailing, and that's very difficult to describe. But when you look at a car, I may be getting off your original question.
That's right. Thank you.
But It was really key. You know, I spent, as you know, some time in Europe, running our operation in Europe, and there was a certain quality that we had in our products in Europe that we frankly didn't have here. And it's a visual thing,
yeah,
Dave. It's not
right.
That this molding will not hang on any better, or this bumper won't function, or the window won't go up and down any better. No, the functions were all there.
Pizzazz and flair that didn't come over here.
But yeah, it was almost an intangible thing, and I've been trying to isolate it ever since I've been a designer, I think, but especially after my time in Europe. Started with being in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Started when I left America.
Right.
When I could look back at America, be outside, and look at America more objectively and say, what are these other people doing that we're not doing there? Why do they have a look? And I think Australia was really an eye-opener for me, because Australia was really neutral. It wasn't American, it wasn't European. Australia could get the best of both worlds. If you were a consumer in Australia, or you could even, you know, you could get Oriental cars, American cars, European cars. And after, you know, living there for 4 years and really being with people, I think I could just take a much more objective look at ourselves in this total world picture and say, well, you know, why do these Australians really buy Mercedes or BMW or a European Ford product? Japanese, what is it about it? And I really tried to dissect it. And then, again, after spending the time in Europe, I looked into it more. And then coming back to the U.S., I felt a real need to try and get that feel. And so it's not just a European look. It's not just a sloping hood or a faster windshield or flush glass. What is the detailing? How is the car assembled to give it a more quality look? We're using the same gauge sheet metal, we're using the same kind of glass, the same kind of rubber, the same kind of plastic. What are they doing with these materials to make them look more quality?
Mm-hmm.
I got down to shape and form of moldings and the design of a molding and the way it worked with the sheet metal and the way it was detailed into the overall fit and finish of the car. For example, take a belt molding or a window molding. You know, what was it about the way we handled that on our European cars versus American cars that gave it a more quality look? And it got right down to the actual sections of, say, a belt molding. The section of a belt molding, again, you can use the same material here and there, but by the way they designed the section, maybe it had a fuller section to it, a more rounded section. It suggested more depth, more ruggedness, it suggested durability. It looked stronger. And then the way it fit to the sheet metal gave it a better fit, a better look, a more quality fit. And I always thought, you know, plastic has always had, in this country, a cheap connotation. You remember when plastics were first introduced? People don't talk about plastic that much anymore. It's a way of life. 20 years ago, people would say, oh, that's one of those cheap plastic things. Whatever it was, if it was a piece of furniture or a cup or a saucer or a plate or pen or whatever, oh, that's a cheap plastic thing. You don't hear people saying cheap plastic anymore. You know, the Italians never felt that way about plastic. The Italians handled plastic like it was a fine piece of wood that was modeled and carved and formed and shaped, and it had a look of quality about it. For some reason, the Italians never associated a cheap connotation with plastic. I don't know why. They just handled it differently. They had a different way of looking at a piece of material. I'm probably getting a little esoteric here with some of this stuff, but this all plays back into, why does a car look quality? What is it that really, it's not, to me, just door margins being perfectly aligned. That's important. We know how to do that. We're doing that. But to me, it's what's in between those door cuts, the sheet metal in between. How is it handled? How is it developed? How is it fabricated? How is it assembled that gives it the total form, the total shape, a quality look? What makes it a quality looking piece of equipment? Well, excuse me. I gave that a lot of thought and consideration, and I felt one of the issues I'd like to cover here is to get someone in from Europe that understood detailing. And frankly, one of the best guys I could think of in understanding that kind of detailing was a designer that I brought over from Europe, Ray Everts.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray's been with us from the outset of this program. And Ray really has a way of looking at details and working with engineers in developing details that really give a quality look to a car. And I think this was, although Ray was the exec designer on the program under Bob Zokas, the main reason that I wanted, the main reason I wanted Ray to come over here and work on the car was to get the right kind of detailing on this car. Excuse me, we have shape and form guys in this building, you know, guys that really understand shape and form. There was no problem there. I never had any problem there at all. And I think, you know, Bob is one of them. Fritz Mayhew is another one. Dave Turner is another one. These guys really understand new shape, new form. They know how to develop it. They have a beautiful feeling for it. The one ingredient that I felt we needed that was lacking around here was this absolute attention to detail and a knowledge and a background and a feel and this know-how to really get it that we needed. And so what I really believe we achieved with this combination of people, with the, you know, with Ray Everts and his detailing background and ability, and a Fritz Mayhew and a Dave Turner in shape and form, and overall shape and form, is we developed a combination, a team that covered every base, every design base on that car that I believe was absolutely essential to pull off the right kind of product, the best in class product. So by combining these people on this team, and it was really interesting to see this team work because they had a lot of divergent ideas on how Ray, you know, Ray had certain feelings about basic shape and form and contour that was not necessarily shared by, say, Fritz and Dave. And that's no problem, and I wasn't worried about that because I knew we would be able to work out the right shape and basic shape and form of the car and then handle the detail. As a matter of fact, the way we handle the program, so once the basic shape and form of the car was established, which was very heavily influenced by, of course, Bob Zokas and Fritz and Dave. After about a year or so on the program, once we pinned down the basic silhouettes of the cars, the basic shapes, the basic format, the basic graphics, I was able to move Fritz and Dave off the project onto some new projects where I felt it was necessary to have them move into. But continued on with Ray Everts on that project to ensure that the detailing was up to the quality standard that we initially set out for ourselves. And he did. He will be on the program, you know, right on through, right on following through, right on through launch, and working with the plant and ensuring that we do maintain original design intent on those cars. So it was a real combination of people. We had some diversified talent working on that car. And it was the first time that I have ever put together a team, and it's interesting in retrospect now to think of the process that I personally went through in putting this team together. And it was the first time that I ever put together a team like this that gave me the complete confidence that I was covered on every detail, that in more than I had ever been covered before. Because I've had, you know, guys work on cars and that were just good detail guys, or guys that were just good shape and form guys. But to really get the right combination, the right team together, which is sometimes difficult to do personality-wise, too, because they don't necessarily always click with each other. You know, they can get in each other's way. So there was a little bit of orchestration to do there to get the right kind of music to come out of that orchestra. And I think we got it, Dave. I got to hand it to these people. You know, there was a... It's a team. As if you're building a football team, you have to have the right players. You know, you have to have the different skills. And people may not think that way about designers in general. They say if the guy's a designer, he's a designer. But there are designers that are especially good in particular areas of design. I'm really breaking it down into finite detail, but that's why we did it on this program. And I think we'll see that it'll pay off when those babies start rolling off the production line. I really mean that. I mean, more so than any other car. The Thunderbird, excuse me, the 83 Thunderbird's a terrific car. I don't think it'll come close to detailing to what we're doing on Taurus and Sable. And this is setting a new standard for us, which you'll see on all our up-and-coming cars. So this wasn't even an experiment. This was just a gathering of background and knowledge that I had experienced around the world and had been wanting to put together for some time. And this project walked in the door, and the company really stood behind us, and Mr. Caldwell was here when we started the project. Of course, Mr. Peterson was the president. And they laid out the ground rules too, saying, you know, we have to be best in class. We want this kind, and they supported us on this, and they, you know, insisted that we come up with a different looking car. We've got to make a statement out there. And how do you do it? Well, that's easy to do. We can make a statement, but it's gotta be a good statement, it's gotta be a quality statement. So I think with the assemblage of this type of team that we put together here, and with Lou Veraldi's driving force coming through every aspect, and support, not just driving force, but support. And Lou, really, I can't tell you how important it is to have the engineer's support mm-hmm. on a program like this to make it work. It's going to connect. That's all there is to it. So it's the people, it's the team that did it. But I'm absolutely delighted with these cars. They have to be winners, Dave. They just have to be winners. One other thing that the designers did, that we were just in the process here, too. We were getting into the process of our whole employee involvement program here in the design center. Well, throughout the whole corporation, but we had a concerted effort here in the design center. We were working with an outside management consultant from California who's been with us now for about over 3 years, and we were just treating ourselves differently in the design center. All of our people, we wanted more participation. We wanted more bottom-up type management style in the building, not top-down. I did not want to stand there and tell them what this car should be, or how it should look. I don't want to get into the detail. I felt it was important for me to develop a design team that would give, you know, come from the bottom up, and especially with the young guys. I wanted the young guys' input into this car. I wanted new ideas, fresh ideas. So it was my job to create an environment here in the design center where people could express themselves. And this is all part of it, and I think that it's all culminating in this kind of a car, and this is a result of that kind of an environment. And I think that's my real role here. I'm not supposed to go out and know every last detail about it or design every last detail. I have to create an environment where we will get the best details and design any place, because it's out there in the building. All I have to do is set the stage for it and make sure that it happens. Give them the leadership. And I think that's what we believe in now in this corporation, especially here in the design centers. We don't believe in management. We believe in leadership. Let people express themselves. This is supposed to be an idea mill.
Right.
Well, I've got to get ideas out. If we don't get new ideas out of this building, we're out of business. And this is the way to do it. And I think that was a driving force behind this, too. So it was happening at a time when we were really into employee involvement. And I think this affected the whole process that these people used when our designers laid out their objectives and were able to talk about it and put their ideas on the wall and let's go through it. We had a lot of very open discussion, very open design discussion on it, which was
a
very
freer discussion atmosphere than you had before.
Very definitely, and it was kind of hard to really initiate that because people, just designers, weren't used to working that way in this building. They really weren't. But I think that this helped pull more of them out of their shells and allow them to express themselves. And then they felt better about it. They felt better about themselves because they made more of a contribution to the program. And I'm not just talking about the few names I mentioned, but I'm talking about all the designers and the modelers and everybody that was involved in the program. And they knew it was their baby, their car. And it wasn't taken away from them and given to this feasibility study. They handled it all the way through, and they're still on it. A lot of those guys are still on it, and the car will be going in production, you know, in about another month and a half or so.
The advance reports have been rather good, and especially the emphasis on, you mentioned earlier, ergonomics, which I guess is the science of making the driver comfortable. And you had put much more detail into that theater than perhaps you've had in the past.
Well, we did, and again, it was much easier to do when starting with a clean piece of paper. We weren't starting with any carryover components. But the whole field of ergonomics deals with the relationship of man to machine and how man better relates to machine, and as far as operation of controls, switches, visibility of all instrumentation, visibility of the road, etc., and seating comfort, and this got into the seats of this car, which we did a lot of market research on to find and develop the best seat in the world. We wanted the best in class seat. And that doesn't mean it has to be the most expensive seat, you know, because it doesn't, but it can be best in class, and we believe we achieved that. And we market researched and test drove what we consider the best seats in the world, European and American, and develop the seats for the Taurus and Sable based on the market research that the conclusion that we got from that, and tested a number of people in a driving mode, not just static seats, not just static seating, because you can get a totally different picture from that. But these seats are comfortable, and the big issue there is we wanted to eliminate driver fatigue. And by eliminating driver fatigue, you have a safer driver. He is more alert, he or she will be more alert and be able to handle the car better under all circumstances and react better and more quickly. And we think we achieved that. And so again, we set out for best-in-class ergonomics, and we believe we did achieve it. Even right down to the design of the knobs and controls on the instrument panel. For example, we have twist knobs on the heater and AC controls on these cars. And again, for feel, for quick reach, quick identification, so the driver doesn't have to take his eyes off the road for any extended length of time to understand how to operate any of the equipment. And we found out something really interesting in market research. We were concerned about the twist controls, thinking people may not like them or understand them. And we found they really did like them, and especially women like them, because they associated the twist controls with their appliances at home, ranges, and this sort of thing. Right. They really understood it, and the logic behind a twist dial just made eminent sense to them.
Because the tactile feel made them feel.
The tactile feel, yeah. And this all plays back into it, and this all helps, again, suggest the quality of the car, too. Tactile experience is extremely important. The sound, the feel, the touch. You know, we're appealing to the senses here. This is, what is quality? How does it come through to people? They feel it in many ways, and that's important to get all the controls right, too, to make sure that you have answered that requirement.
And you can adapt very easily, I think, to digital readouts, of course.
Well, you can, but again, we're not trying to make that decision for people, and we've had many long discussions on that in the corporation on digital readouts versus analog.
Yeah.
And so we are offering both. We are not trying to pin that down. Generally, younger people like digital, more mature people like analog, performance-oriented people like analog. We can do electronic, analog. We've got all the combinations, and we feel it's not up to us to make that decision. It's up to us to offer both to the consumer and let them make the decision. And it'll probably be a 50-50 split on it. So we're not going to stand here and say one is better than the other. It's like front-wheel drive versus rear-wheel drive. If we're really customer-driven, we better offer both as long as there's that kind of a split in the marketplace. And that's been our approach to it. My real role here as Chief Design Executive for Ford North American Design is one of, I describe it as acting as a catalyst to pull the right kinds of talent together and create an environment for this talent to function in and to offer the kind of leadership that allows and helps these teams of people in the creative process. I feel it's extremely important to build the kind of an environment here that will allow people to surface ideas and express themselves and feel free enough to come forth with new ideas and not punish people that come up with new ideas that don't necessarily work. You know, some of the best, in Search for Excellence, they talked about a company that gave the Golden Banana Award to people who had an idea that they tried developing that didn't make it. But I think the importance of that is you acknowledge people's creativity, their creative minds, and acknowledge the fact that they are trying to be creative, even if that idea isn't worthwhile at the moment. And I really try to encourage that kind of thinking in our design center here. I think it's absolutely essential to continue a spirit in a building and an operation like this to come up with more innovative and creative design. I think that my basic design philosophy still is one of form follows function, with that extra F that I added, which is flair. Design still must be exciting. I think you can follow a form follows function theory and frankly be very boring.
Mm.
I think it's important to add that extra ingredient of flair, because people still do become very emotional about designs, whether it's automobiles or clothing or furniture or architecture or what have you. And I think that's great. I think it's exciting. I think we're in a very exciting business. And I think we can be the best as long as we continue on that path and offer something different, something unique, something exciting, something good. It's got to be well designed. That's why it's got to be functional. You can't just be exciting and non-functional. There are plenty of cars like that on the road. I mean, my kids all love the Lamborghini Countach. That you can't have any more excitement than you get in that car. Unfortunately, people can't ride more than 5 miles in that car without going nuts, but it's exciting. That isn't the whole answer. We have to provide excitement, but we have to provide functional automobiles, real-world automobiles, and I think that's what we'll continue to do here in the Ford Motor Company, So I really believe that in the future you will see more of the best of today. You will see a progression, an evolution of evolutionary progression of the aero look. As I mentioned earlier, we won't talk about aerodynamics that much. It will just be an integral part of design. It's accepted. It's, if it isn't there, you will miss it. We will have it. And you'll see cleaner designs. I'm hoping, if I have anything to say about it, you'll see more exciting designs. You will see a certain uniqueness in Ford products that you won't see in other manufacturers. That's my whole goal, and my whole mission here. I think one of the key words in our up-and-coming designs, Dave, will be distinctiveness of design. We must have a distinctiveness there that has an appeal, an excitement, a flair, and I think a driving force behind it that will guide people into our showrooms and make them want our products over others. We will have that extra ingredient X. We will be on that leading edge because we really believe in it. We have the talent, we have the wherewithal right here in this building, in this design center, to do it. I have told my people in a number of meetings that I've had with them, I've held vision, what I call vision meetings. We've actually developed a vision document here of where we want to be in the future. I'd be glad to give you a copy of that.
Yes.
Excuse me. I believe, and I'm very, very sincere about this, I believe we have the best design center in the world. We have some of the best talent in the world right here in this building. And I've been in design centers around the world, in Asia, in Australia, in Europe, England, Germany, Italy, in competitive studios, large ones, small ones. I've been in American design operations. I have a pretty good fix on the talent out there. I try to keep abreast of it. I try to keep abreast of the new up-and-coming talent around the world on our recruiting trips around the world, that sort of thing. And I've got to tell you, and I've told this to my people, and I'm absolutely serious about this, we've got some of the best talent in the world here. So I've got some of the best ingredients, the makeup of the best design center in the world, and I believe we can be the best design center in the world, and we will be, and I've told this to my people, and I firmly believe it. And I kind of think they're getting more and more convinced of that every day when they see the kinds of designs they can turn out, because they're proud of what they do now. They want to drive the cars that they do. They want to tell their friends they work for the Ford Motor Company. And I think when this happens, and it is happening, we'll have the wherewithal to develop the most distinctive designs out there. And I think our competition is really going to have something to be concerned about, because we're using a different process. And internally, we are using a different design process. We are coming up with design solutions through a process that I believe nobody else in the world is using, domestically or foreign. We've got our own unique design process that I am really developing here, and our people are really developing, and they are totally involved in it. And I think with that kind of commitment on the part of our people here, and the commitment, my own personal commitment to it, we really have the building blocks in place to be the best design group around and come up with the best designs.
Do you feel that the company then is committed to this vision as well? Have you been able to bring them along as witness the Taurus Sable concept?
Yeah, I really believe the company is, and I think the company, the corporation, has given the design center enough autonomy to express itself, and we developed our own vision, which very definitely complements the overall vision and direction that the corporation is moving in. So I think this is a unique part about the Ford Motor Company. I'm not sure if other corporations operate this way, but when we developed our own in-house design center strategies for the type of organization we would like to have, we were allowed to bring in our own outside consultant to work with us, our own management consultant, as other areas around the corporation were able to do, rather than just having one outside consultant handle the whole corporation. So we were treated as separate entities, but working together as a total corporation. And I think this was a kind of a great approach to use, and it allowed the kind of freedom, departmental freedom around the corporation to give them their own identity and allow them to express themselves in a more creative way. And I think this is what is really working as a corporation and as a separate unit in the corporation here. We were able to develop our own vision, which complemented the total corporate vision. And that was part of the intent of it. You know, it had to work. Although we wanted to develop our own vision, we knew it had to work with the basic corporate goals and corporate objectives and the total mission of the corporation. And it's doing that. And so it's nice to be able to have this kind of autonomy and yet be part of the big picture and work well together. And so I think it should be a very successful corporate operation, the way we've developed it.
Test.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me, Jack, that it would be helpful if, for our listeners in years to come, if you could tell us where Ford is at this critical juncture in design history and what you're planning for the next 15 years to the end of the decade in terms of design and design philosophy, and what hopefully you're coming up with something different and or at least an improvement on the current models.
All right. I think to describe where we are at the moment, that is our design position in the Ford Motor Company, I have to just briefly tell you a little bit about how we arrived at this and where we're coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that would be.
And I think over the last few years, our management has developed a strategy and a corporate philosophy, a corporate design philosophy that we have been adhering to and are evolving now. And we are really developing a strategy that is very, very concerned with the customer. We're holding meetings at the moment entitled Concept to Customer, and the customer is really focused upon in a way that we have never focused upon the customer before, because we really believe, and I subscribe to this, by the way, that if the product isn't right, if it doesn't appeal to the customer on the showroom floor, no matter what we say is right, it really doesn't matter. Now, in all fairness, the customer is looking to designers and engineers for some guidance, but the guidance that we give them really has to fit into their general lifestyle. And I think there's been a very concerted effort on the part of the corporation to meet this customer goal now, or the customer's wants, I should say. So this is really, this is one of the guiding principles that is that's moving us through this decade. And I think you'll see it expressed in the designs, in our upcoming designs, and the designs that will be on the road in the very near term, meaning the Taurus and Sable. We feel that those are very definitely customer-driven type designs.
This is mid 85, and you're coming out in the fall of 85.
That's right. That'll be the fall of 85. Those cars will be introduced in November. They go into production next month in September of 85. It'll be 86 models. And we say we're customer driven. We've done probably more market research now on these cars, on the Taurus and Sable, than any other car program that I've ever been involved in. But it's a different type of research. We are listening, I think, to some degree, with these new designs. We will not only be listening, but we will be telling or guiding the customer too, because I think the customer can't tell us exactly what he wants in the future, not knowing what the future environment will be, and without knowing what options he will have to select from when it comes to the time for him to make his purchase. But we can still listen to the customers. We know what we know generally what they want. I think the probably the most difficult part of this equation is to add to what the customer wants. How do you give the customer something he doesn't know he wants?
Good.
Now that's a tricky equation, okay? But it's not impossible. And that's our job. Now I guess it isn't spelled out that way in our corporation. We're just saying we're customer driven. But I think we have to take it one step beyond here in the design center. We have to give the customer something he doesn't know he wants. We have to, first off, we have to satisfy all his needs. We have to give him everything he wants. That's rule number one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but the next issue is how do we give him that extra ingredient X, I'll call it, reaching out into space and trying to find out what ingredient X is that we think he will want and we know he'll want. And I suppose in the past we have made customers want ingredient X, whatever it is, without them ever knowing about it 5 years hence. So this I think is having a very strong influence on all of our up and coming designs. But I think based on what we're learning from the customer, they are the American buyer, which is, you know, is the person we're really focusing on, and the American buyer is becoming more and more international every day. I think tastes worldwide basis are evolving and are becoming very similar, whether it would be in Europe, Asia Pacific, or America. They really are. It's not there yet, it's not 100% at this point. It doesn't mean you can't sell one car all over the world, because it's being done now and done successfully. But our primary goal here in North America is to obviously please the American buyer. We are out for the American market.
Right.
If our products happen to spill over into Asia Pacific or Europe, that's fine too. And I think with the types of products that we're developing now, they'll certainly have that potential. I think some of the demands that we're picking up in the marketplace now are, now that the fuel economy issue has somewhat settled down in 1985, because the supply is there, all we're dickering is price at the moment, and that doesn't seem to be that large an issue, and I think the buyers are really understanding that it isn't as large an issue as it appeared to be a few years ago. And I only say that because if you look at the price of fuel today, say, well, we'll just take $1 a gallon for a base. I know you can go $1.25, $1.35, but say a dollar a gallon today equates in 1955 economics to 25 cents a gallon. When you bake in inflation,
right?
So it's really still an incredible bargain. That doesn't mean we shouldn't conserve it. We have to conserve it, and you know, we're all for fuel efficiency. But we're giving it to the customer now, even on our large cars. I mean, they're really efficient. By the way, on a recent test drive with our new Taurus, one of our development people just drove one up from the Atlanta plant to Dearborn, and I just got this yesterday from him. He averaged 29 miles to the gallon on the highway with the new Taurus.
Wow.
I mean, this just happened. This is why they weren't trying to just happen. So, I mean, that's really terrific fuel economy for a car like that.
You
know,
part of it was the aerodynamic design, the flush design?
And there's no question. We've contributed in the last 3 years about a mile and a half to our corporate a mile and a half per gallon to our corporate average fuel economy with aero alone.
Yeah.
And when you equate that to what it would cost to achieve a mile and a half in corporate average fuel economy through mechanical means, mechanical developments, engines, carburation, transmissions, et cetera, you're talking probably $2.5 to $3 billion worth of development and investment to achieve that. So we in the design center feel we've made a significant contribution to fuel economy through aerodynamics by a more efficient bending of the sheet metal, if you will. And why not? Yeah. So yeah, we had some bearing, no question about it, and we feel really good about it. And the car looks good, we believe. And as it gets back to your question. So where will we be going? What, you know, what are we doing today, design-wise? We'll be giving people cleaner cars. By clean design, I mean less in the way of add-ons. You'll see more efficient design. And that doesn't mean we'll lack excitement. I think there's something very exciting about pure design. And I think we're getting more to this pure design concept, functional design, as I've talked about before. You know, I always believe form follows function, but it's got to have that extra F flair.
Right.
Or excitement, because people still get emotional about buying automobiles, and I think it's important to deliver on the emotional aspects of an automobile too. Why shouldn't the world be excited? I mean, if you buy a suit of clothes, you'd like to at least like it, or you'd like one suit of clothes over another, or a tie, or a furniture, or a house, or a product, or whatever you buy. I think, however, there's a little more emotional involvement attached to the purchase of an automobile than there is most products. It's a moving, it's a dynamic piece of equipment. Why not? So you'll see this cleaner look, more functional look that we're developing now, and I think you'll see that progressing on into the future, and all of our future designs will be, as far as I'm concerned, will be holding to this formula, and we're holding to it on a worldwide basis, really. And speaking of that, by the way, we are staying, I think, more in tune to the world design-wise here in the Design Center, because we are, for the past few years now, we have been holding international design conferences. I don't know if I mentioned this to you before. Yes, and I'll be attending one next month, September, in Cologne. We're coordinating it with the Frankfurt Auto Show. And at these design conferences, we meet with our design representatives from our design centers around the world, and that's Australia, Japan, Brazil, Argentina, the U.S., Italy, Germany, England, and we all gather in the conference will be in Cologne, Germany, and we'll tie in with the Frankfurt Auto Show, so we'll spend a day or so at the Auto Show and then have our conference.